Joining us now is Jean-Louis Olivier, a PhD student and casual academic at the University of Newcastle. Jean-Louis is here to talk about the work she does in collaboration with Zara's House, a centre for women and children from migrant and refugee backgrounds. Welcome to 3CR, Jean-Louis.
Thanks, Frances.
Thanks so much for joining us. Can you start by introducing your research a little bit more for listeners? What's your PhD on?
So my PhD is interested very broadly in how women from migrant and refugee backgrounds meet everyday care needs. And it's also within the context of continued government divestment from settlement support and welfare more broadly. And my PhD is working in collaboration with Zara's House. I predominantly work with Afghan and a few Iranian women. So before the project started, I volunteered at Zara's House for about a year and a half. And then through that volunteering, I met Hamida and Naja, who are both community leaders at Zara's House. And that's where we sort of did this collaborative process to create these creative workshops to explore how women meet everyday care needs. So that's sort of broadly what the project is about.
Yeah, sounds great. And it's really good, I think, when research comes from the community and from real needs.
Yeah.
And just for listeners who might not be aware, can you tell us a little bit more about Zara's House and what it does?
So it is also completely independent and not federal government funded. So it relies on donations and grants. And it provides, I guess, like classic settlement supports, which include English language class, citizenship test preparation, and that sort of thing. But it also provides a whole heap of other programs that women have said that they'd like. So it's also done things like makeup class, Afghan dance, Afghan embroidery, and also it provides mother tongue language literacy classes taught by Afghan and Arab women more recently. So that came from the fact that many of the Afghan women in particular were illiterate in their mother tongue, so they were unable to read or write in their mother tongue. And Zara's House is really passionate about providing mother tongue literacy as sort of the foundation of learning before learning English. So that sort of sets it apart from other language providers in particular.
Yeah, which sounds so important when we know, you know, the history of like efforts of making migrants and refugees assimilate and just, you know, learn English and leave behind all of these aspects that are so important to them and their identity. And also that focus on, you know, dance and creative pursuits and embroidery, when I think so often ideas about what refugees and migrants need are just like, yeah, basic needs. Like, do they have a house? Do they have language? Yeah. So in your work, you're focusing on creative methods and co-collaboration. Can you tell us a bit more about the zine work that you've been doing?
Yeah, so the zine, so we did creative workshops for 9 weeks, and the zine was the end sort of project that we worked on together. And the reason that the zine came about in my discussion with Hamida and Naja was thinking about ways that women who were participating in this research project could actually have something tangible at the end. Because for my PhD, it's all by research article, which is very inaccessible, as we know, on a good day. So we thought, like, how can we create something that people who are participating can actually have and understand how their work has contributed to this PhD? So we did things like photography workshops, embroidery, poetry, and then with all of those things that women created, they each got to work on a couple of pages for the zine from all of their creative work. And we also emphasized that people didn't need to use any written language if they didn't want to or weren't able to. So it was really emphasizing photographs, drawings, photographs of their creative works. And what came out in the end was a zine that was co-authored by more than 50 women, very broadly about care in Newcastle. And what really came out was themes of friendship and joy and happiness through that zine, which was really beautiful. And it didn't come from myself. I didn't ask questions about friendship or joy or happiness, but that was what women shared with me. And the title of the zine itself, Tea and Thread, Our Happiness, came from a collective discussion of what we'd like to call our zine. Yeah,
it's so important to have that co-creation, and you're right that there's so much sort of traditional academic research that, does interviews and so forth with marginalized communities and basically just extracts stories and it never goes back to the community. So, yeah, it sounds like you've found a really collaborative approach. This focus on happiness and joy, I think, is so important in the current era. Why do you think that there needs to be, or why do you think that there is this focus on happiness and joy in the current moment when we're seeing so much of the negative media and political discourse on refugees as well?
Yeah, I think that it is tricky, particularly given what the current context is in Afghanistan and Iran for women. And I have got questions in the past, like it seems a bit of a stark contrast, it's like a focus on joy and happiness when there is some really horrific things happening. But I think that it's really important that there's space for self-narrative and autonomy for women to tell the stories that they would like to share. And I could have asked about trauma, but that just also wasn't appropriate coming from me because I'm not, a mental health professional or anything like that. And the stories that women wanted to share with me were of happiness and joy and friendship. I thought that was really important to share, particularly with current narratives around Afghan women in particular as sort of victims and helpless and all of those horrible narratives of needing to be saved. But in this project, what women emphasized to me is Afghan women have many great talents and ideas and knowledge to share and a desire to share that. So I think that that's really important to listen to what women want to share. Also in the Australian context, so this is based in Newcastle, and as women are making home here, that's what they wanted to share.
Mm. And is there a next step in this project? What do you plan to do with the zines or with future projects?
That's a great question. So the most recent thing that we did, we had a big celebration where everyone who participated got a certificate, got the zine, because it actually took a long time to compile the zine. So everyone made like 2 or 3 pages and then had to compile that into one sort of cohesive zine. So everyone got their zines, and that was really, really exciting. And we were dancing and playing the dust drum, a traditional Afghan drum, and it was really, really beautiful. And from here, with consent from the group, I might continue to share like an anonymous version of the zine. Haven't decided yet if that will be available online. And also we're going to do another exhibition of some of the women's embroidery in mid-2025 in Newcastle. So that will be sort of the next step. And also I've got a, speaking of academic journal articles, my academic journal article for Asia Pacific Viewpoint should be out soon, and that's co-authored with Tamada and Nadja, who did the workshop with me, and my PhD supervisor. So that's really about this sort of ethic of creative methods and working with research communities and alongside and in solidarity with research communities, and the importance of co-authoring that with your collaborators. Yeah,
it's so good, and it should be obviously done way more, but we still see academic articles published by, you know, a lot in the global north, and a lot, you know, dominated by white people of a certain education. So yeah, it's great. The work that you're doing, well done.
Thanks.
Is there anything else you wanted to share before we have to go?
I just thought very quickly I would plug, if people wanted to know more about what Afghan and Iranian women are campaigning for themselves, there's a pretty big campaign called End Gender Apartheid, and you can find out more information at endgenderapartheid.today. Those are women advocating from Afghanistan and Iran. And you can also check out the work of Azada Raz Mohammed, who is the legal advisor on that End Gender Apartheid campaign, and actually a PhD student at Uni Melbourne, and also the work of Dr. Baha Jalali, who has been a really awesome advocate in opposition to some of the Taliban's restrictive rules at the moment.
Yeah, amazing. And I'll get you to share those with me so I can put them in the show notes for people who want to follow up later.
Great. Thanks, Frances.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. So that was Jean-Louise Olivier, PhD student and casual academic at the University of Newcastle, speaking with us about her work with refugee and migrant women, especially Afghan women, at Zara's House on creative projects and collaboration.
Yara is a Palestinian Nam / Melbourne-based soul singer, songwriter and producer, and this song comes from her 2023 EP, Lonely Love Affair. Here's Yara with Hard Thing, and there's just a language warning for this song.
You take my time and my energy. Should be paying for my therapy. There's only so much healing I can do before I start blaming you. Yeah, I believe in forgiveness, but with God as my witness, oh, she knows the shit you put me through. Nothing.
And that was the song Hard Thing by Yara. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM and streaming online at 3cr.org.au. We are now joined by Laura John, Associate Legal Director at the Human Rights Law Centre. A little over a week ago, the Albanese government made a deal with the opposition to pass brutal, draconian migration laws that seek to further dehumanise and attack migrant and refugee communities. These bills include the Migration Amendment Removal and Other Measures Bill 2024, Migration Amendment Bill 2024, and the Migration Amendment Prohibiting Items in Immigration Detention Facilities Bill 2024. Laura joins us this morning to explain these bills in more detail and the impact this will have on migrants and refugees in this country. Welcome back to Tuesday Breakfast, Laura.
Good morning. It's great to be here, especially on International Human Rights Day.
Yes, and on that note, I was wondering if you could just reflect on this day being International Human Rights Day and speak about, you know, the context of these laws and what this means for the rights of migrants and refugees in this country.
Well, on International Human Rights Day, we commemorate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the foundational blueprint document that our government and our politicians tell us they're very much committed to. Now, this is a foundational document that tells us that human rights can empower individuals and communities to forge a better tomorrow. It provides the bedrock of rights to liberty, to security, and freedom of race, colour, religion, sex, language, political and other opinions. So it's particularly disappointing that on International Human Rights Day, we're here talking about broad, unprecedented, sweeping new powers that the government has introduced just in the last week that, as you say, really target migrant and refugee communities. But beyond that, these laws are going to have an impact on every single Australian.
Mm. Yeah, and I was wondering if you could explain these bills in a bit more detail.
So there are three pieces of legislation that were passed last week in a secret deal between Labor and the Coalition. They give the Minister for Immigration unprecedented sweeping new powers to impose a Trump-style travel ban on entire countries, to jail people who don't assist with their own deportation, regardless of how long they've been here in Australia or whether they have Australian children. And they give the Minister the power to permanently exile people to third countries. So the effects of these laws will be felt throughout migrant and refugee communities. They'll have a particular impact on victim survivors of family violence, who we know are predominantly women. But they're also going to affect every Australian who has co-workers, neighbours, friends and families who might fall victim to these laws.
Mm. Yeah, and, you know, when we're constantly hearing messages from the government about how seriously they take domestic violence, violence against women, how they value things like quote-unquote social cohesion, it really is a slap in the face to then pass these bills in a rushed and secretive way without any sort of consulting with the wider community. It really just goes to show how little they care about not just migrants and refugees, but like you said, the broader community here.
That's right. And I think we should keep in mind that these laws have been passed without adequate scrutiny that completely flies in the face of our democratic foundations. But even with that limited opportunity for people to provide their input into these laws, when the deportation bill was debated in the Senate earlier this year, so this is in March to May, every single submission to the Senate inquiry opposed the bill, other than the submission of the Department of Home Affairs. And when the Migration Amendment Bill was debated a couple of weeks ago, despite people only being given 3 days to make a submission to the parliamentary inquiry, 114 community members, faith groups, legal experts and human rights organisations wrote to the committee to overwhelmingly oppose the bill. So in the face of that community opposition, it's outstanding that the government and the coalition would team together and make a secret deal to pass these laws through literally in the dead of the night.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, and, you know, they often talk about how again, they value things like democracy and hearing from the people and what they want. But again, this is just another piece of evidence that they don't. And it just goes to show how important the upcoming federal election is going to be in terms of people making their voices heard and really telling the government how they feel about these bills and their treatment of migrants and refugees, and especially just reflecting on the last federal election where the Labor Party made an election promise to the family in Bilawila to grant them permanent visas. And now, you know, several years later, introducing these bills that dehumanize migrants and refugees. I was wondering if you could reflect on that and just chat a bit about, you know, what people can do in terms of the upcoming election to make their voices heard.
I just want to acknowledge that the human impact of these new laws is devastating. And I've certainly spent the last week speaking with clients and members of the community who are incredibly distressed about what these laws could mean for their families. Because we're dealing here with real people who have families, jobs and communities in Australia. These are people who are healthcare workers, they are aged care workers. They are people who are contributing to our communities. Their kids are in our local schools. So I think when people go to vote at the next federal election, they should think really carefully about the type of Australia that they want to be part of and the type of Australia they want to endorse. Because for me, and my family comes from a migrant background, the Australia that we want to help build is one in which people are welcomed and accepted regardless of the colour of their skin. It's one in which people, all people, are given a fair go. And I think what we've seen in Parliament in the last couple of weeks, but also in the last year, really makes me doubt whether either of the major parties are able to represent that Australia that I know myself, my family and our communities really deserve. Mm.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that we can all reflect on in the upcoming months. Laura, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about international law and whether, you know, this cohort of migrants and refugees have any legal recourse when it comes to pushing back against these bills that have just been passed.
Well, I think really the ultimate way in which we can push back is to push back on our politicians. Mm. These laws might have been passed, but the way in which they are framed requires the minister to take further steps, for example, to make determinations. So I think the very first step is that we have to keep the pressure on our politicians to let them know that just because these laws are on the books doesn't mean that, that the community wants them to use the laws. I think that's the first aspect. In terms of international law, as you say, today is International Human Rights Day, and there are certainly rights that people are entitled to under international law. For example, rights for refugees not to be sent back to countries where they might face persecution. There are rights to family unity, and that's another area that we're very concerned about with the operation of these laws. But unfortunately, the way in which the Australian legal system has been crafted means that it's very difficult for people to make direct complaints to those UN agencies. So while that's definitely a possibility, I think what we need to focus on is what's happening on the ground in Australia and try and utilise those mechanisms that we have in our democracy, like the upcoming election, like contacting our senators and members of parliament, to make sure that they know that we don't accept these secret deals made in the dead of night, and the community really wants to say in how these laws will be used.
Yeah. And in terms of how these bills will impact your work in the space where you're advocating for migrants and refugees, can you talk a bit about that and what's next for you and other lawyers and refugee advocates who are working in this space?
Our focus at the moment is on continuing to advocate for our clients. And as I said, I've spent the last week, as many of my colleagues have, providing advice and support to people who are incredibly distressed about what these laws might mean to them. And let me just give you a few examples of how this might play out. We might have a situation where there is a child who is an Australian citizen, but their parent, one parent or both parents, are not. And so the parents could be forced to cooperate with their own removal. If they are unable to comply, they might be thrown in jail. Hmm. The parents might be sent to some unspecified third country, and there's nothing to stop the children then being separated from their parents. And I mentioned earlier one of the key concerns that we have with this new package of legislation is that it really does not provide adequate protections for victim survivors of family violence. So imagine a situation where you've got a mum, you've got a, the dad is the perpetrator of violence, and you've got a child. The mother could be forced by the Minister for Immigration to, for example, take steps to get a passport for the child. But they won't be able to do that without liaising with the perpetrator of violence. And if the mother can't do that, they end up in jail. Or alternatively, say the child's an Australian citizen, what that means is that the mother could be deported and the child could be placed in the care of the perpetrator of violence or under state care. Now, there's nothing in this package of laws that shows any sophistication in the government's thinking about how these complex scenarios will play out. So our focus is going to be on making sure that our clients and any members of the community have accurate legal assistance so they know what they need to do if they are targeted by these laws.
Mm. Yeah, thank you so much for explaining that to us in a bit more detail, Laura. And I think, you know, especially as we're reflecting on the end of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, I think a lot of the time we need to really think about that the fact that gender-based violence can come in the form of, you know, state-sanctioned violence and in laws that are passed by the government. I think so often we think about violence as, you know, interpersonal violence that's perpetrated by an individual. But that does often allow institutions and governments to get away with their own form of violence and their neglect of violence against women and children.
We know that our laws and our systems and our institutions don't adequately protect victims, survivors of family violence. I think every politician in Australia is acutely aware of that. And yet, at the same time, we've got the Minister for Immigration giving himself the power to ban entire countries of people from even coming to Australia. So imagine how that would impact a woman who's been exit trafficked and who is trying to re-enter Australia to get support. It's astonishing that, on the one hand, we have a government that says it's committed to protecting victims, survivors of family violence, and on the other hand, is introducing laws that will not only perpetrate further violence against this group of highly vulnerable women, but is likely to exacerbate the conditions they're already facing.
Yeah, definitely. And I was wondering if you could just quickly talk about the importance of having a mobile phone, or I was wondering if you could just explain a bit more that law or that bill that seeks to ban mobile phones in immigration detention and what that will mean for people who are trying to seek help and stay in contact with their legal team but also with their families.
We know that mobile phones are a lifeline for people in detention. That's how people stay connected, not only with their family and friends, but also with their lawyers. And we also know that the immigration detention system has been in crisis for years. The current average period of detention is 513 days. That's nearly 1.5 years. So banning mobile phones will mean that people are kept isolated from their loved ones for months or even years. It means that people will not be able to hear their partner's voice or see their child's face as they grow up. But we also know that mobile phones are critical to people's liberty. It's through mobile phones that people have been able to communicate with their lawyers to advance their case to be freed from detention or to prevent illegal conduct from occurring. Because abuse thrives behind closed doors. And mobile phones and internet access have been crucial for people in shining a light on their mistreatment in Australian immigration detention centres. So we really shouldn't have a different standard for people who are denied their liberty simply because of their visa status.
Yeah, and, you know, I read that Minister Burke said, you know, this ban is to stop people from engaging in criminal activity on their phones. But of course, we know that, like, these sorts of laws will impact everyone and will give, you know, those in power any sort of excuse to restrict people's liberties and take away their phones without really needing any sort of real concrete evidence before they do that.
And we've heard a lot from this government about how this package of laws are directed to community safety. But there's no evidence that any of these laws will improve community safety. And indeed, there's no evidence that we have a problem with community safety that is limited to people who are migrants or refugees. It's just that that group once again become the political scapegoat so that Labor and the Coalition can make a secret deal in the dying days of Parliament in order to further criminalise and victimise this one small group for political gain. So it's really not the way in which robust lawmaking should occur. There's a complete absence of any evidence. And I think it's quite clear what is happening here. It's migrant and refugee communities again being targeted by a government that thinks that this will enable it to hold on to power at the next federal election. And I think that's very doubtful.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Laura, for coming on the show and speaking to us about this this really important issue. I think you've given us a lot to reflect on, especially today on International Human Rights Day, and also, given us something to think about and to get us into action before the next federal election. So thanks again, Laura.